Corey Goldsworthy, the supervisor of Lake Superior Fisheries from the Minnesota DNR, has been a guest actually several times, but not for a few years. So thanks for coming back, Corey.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
We have a lot we could talk about. Everyone, I think, has interest in fish and also in Lake Superior, and you know a lot more about both than many people. So let's start by talking about Cisco. There's been some interesting developments with the Cisco on Lake Superior. Tell me about that.
Yeah, there has been. You know, for the last 15 or 20 years, what we've seen on Lake Superior with Cisco, also known as herring or tulipy to local folks here, what we've noticed is we know that they spawn every year in the fall. We know that in the spring those eggs hatch and those little fish go swimming around, but they don't always survive to age one.
Okay.
And if those small fish can survive to age one, then we know they will come back as spawning adults and keep that population, the abundance of that population, up. What we've noticed is those recruitment events, those fish living to age one, haven't always occurred, and they've been occurring less frequently and at lower amplitude, so not as many, not as strong of a recruitment event occurring. So just naturally, then it's a numbers game. So as we're trying to manage a commercial fishery and set quotas, as those abundance numbers decline, the quotas also decline. And, you know, there's been a few things that have been attributed to it. Ice cover has been one of the things that researchers have kind of zeroed in on.
The lack of.
The lack of, correct. Yeah. Yep. So if we do get a good ice cover event, typically that means we'll see a decent Cisco or Lake Herring recruitment event. Not always, right?
But we know why that is? What's the connection?
Good question.
I've heard it's about spawning and having the eggs be able to.
Yep. So there's a few studies, I think, still going underway looking at whether it has something to do with ice cover and light penetration and when those eggs hatch and when those free swimming fry or larval fish come out. The other thing has been water temperature in the spring. So there's a match mismatch hypothesis with Cisco hatching and zooplankton production. So as those young fish hatch out of their eggs, they have a yolk sac that they can survive on for a short period of time. When that yolk sac is absorbed, then they've got to go out and start looking for food. If that food isn't available, meaning zooplankton, then those little fish essentially starve and die. And what mismatch hypothesis is that these cold water events or ice cover events allow the appropriate timing for zooplankton events to occur with Cisco hatching and the absorption of that egg yolk sac. And then yolk sac is done. I need to feed. Hey, there's a lot of zooplankton available. That's what we think we saw in 2022. So as we were doing our hydroacoustics assessments last year, hydroacoustics is just a scientific grade fish finder. We're towing a midwater trawl, big midwater trawl behind the research vessel Blue Heron.
Okay.
That's operated by the University of Minnesota Duluth Large Lakes Observatory. We do our surveys there. We collected a lot of age zero or juvenile Cisco, bloater, and kayai. Bloater and kayai are the smaller relative of Cisco. Kayai live in the deepest parts of Lake Superior. Bloater are more shallower, but they barely exceed 6 to 8 inches, where Cisco will get to about 15, 16, 17 inches. But we saw for those three species, Cisco, bloater, kayai, just an absolutely incredible recruitment event, we think. We're waiting on surveys from the USGS this spring, bottom trawl surveys in the Big Blue Boat, to verify or confirm that those fish actually survive to age one. Because in that survey, we know the number of age one Cisco, bloater, kayai that they catch is representative of how strong that recruitment event was. So we're really anticipating that survey to get done this year and see what that year class strength was, because, you know, in the last 5 years, we have seen some of the lowest abundances of Cisco that we've seen in, I think, since 1970. So,
yeah, well, I know the fishermen out at the breakwell, we walk by there most mornings and chat with them, and they have definitely talked about a lack of Cisco.
Correct.
Recently.
Correct.
And so I think what you're saying is there's hope for a bumper crop this year, but, you know, that hasn't been confirmed yet or even declared, but it could be.
Right. Yep. We have our fingers crossed, and we're fairly positive that this thing is going to occur. It's just we need that final piece of evidence from the USGS, because one component that we don't know is, of course, in our fisheries sampling, we sample, essentially May through October, November, but then there's a huge chunk of the year during the winter that we can't sample, and we don't know what really happens during that time period. I mean, for all we know, all of those young fish we saw in the fall could already be eaten by, the rehabilitated lake trout population that we've worked on restoring for 65 years, and we know is really abundant at this point.
So. Okay. And so just a general picture, I've always kind of wondered this. Obviously, you're testing what is sort of naturally going to be there, and then you're also feeding the lake with fish, and that the amounts that you feed just kind of ebbs and flows depending on what's naturally there. Is that an accurate depiction of how you work?
It is, yep. We've really moved into, and I say we, I mean collectively as fisheries managers across Lake Superior, really moved into more of an ecosystem management type approach to fisheries management rather than, let's just be human-centric and stock what we want and not really take in consideration anything else. And what we've really worked on lately, especially with our rehabilitated lake trout population, is trying to ensure that there's enough prey fish out there to support the large abundance of not only lake trout that we have, but then our non-native salmonids that we have stocked through time to support the sport fisheries, Chinook, coho, salmon, rainbow trout, brown trout.
Okay.
So we've been doing one of the things we've done in the last year lake-wide, all the agencies and tribal agencies. We've done a lake-wide diet study where all of the agencies have saved their stomach samples from predator and prey fish, and we got some EPA funding through the Cooperative Science and Monitoring Initiative on Lake Superior. It happens once every 5 years, and we've got money to have those samples processed the same way all the way across Lake Superior. Hmm. So that gives us a really good idea of what predator fish are eating, what prey fish are eating. Gives us a deep dive into the food web, and that happened in 2021, which was kind of at the lowest point that we've seen prey fish in a long time on Lake Superior. Huh. And now we're going, geez, it'd be really nice to do this again this year when we have this bumper crop of bloater Cisco kayai coming through that are all about 3 to 4 inches long right now, because that's perfect lake trout food, perfect Chinook salmon food. So we really want to get the flip side of this. So we saw what it looks like, what the food web looks like at low prey fish abundance. What does it look like when we have a bumper crop of these prey fish coming through?
Right.
And, my assumption on what we saw last fall was, we caught a few lake trout in our midwater trawls while we were doing hydroacoustics, and they just gorged themselves on juvenile Cisco bloater kayai. I mean, 3 to 4 to 5 tails hanging out of their mouth. They could barely fit another fish in their stomach. So I imagine there's a lot of eating going on right now, especially with our lake trout.
And would you say there is increasing sort of disruption? You're talking about the mismatching in the food chain and the zooplankton being available at the wrong time. Or is that something that's increasing with the greater fluctuating lake temperatures?
Yeah. What we've seen through time, especially on Lake Superior, is the lack of ice cover or the decline in ice cover events with, climate change happening. And, of course, that's something that is really concerning to fisheries managers trying to manage these fisheries that are dependent on these ice cover events. And, for the long term, if we do get large banner year classes like this once every 10 to 15 years, typically that's enough to keep that population going. I mean, the last time that perhaps we've seen this size of year class was either 1984, 88, 89, or 90. And we still see some of those Cisco from those year classes. So they can live to be 40 plus years old.
Really?
Yep. They can live that long. I mean, we'll still see like 2 or 3 a year. But, lake-wide, what we're looking at is we're either looking for 1 or 2 of these huge boomer year class events every 10 or 15 years, or more consistent, smaller recruitment events every 2 to 3 years. And, it'd just be nice to... it's April, 21st right now, and I almost just got stuck in my driveway with the snow.
Yeah.
I'd love to say it'd be nice to see cold weather in the spring, but at this point, I'm ready to move on to spring.
Right. Yeah, tell us a little bit about this spring and how it's moving forward.
Yeah, this spring, typically by this point, we would pretty much almost be in the midpoint or almost done with our steelhead run and spawning operations at the French River. We haven't even started yet. We don't even have the Knife River trap up and running. It's still packed with ice and snow and debris, and we're trying to wait for these overnight temperatures to get above freezing so we can get in there, get all the stop logs in, get the roller screen in, and get it up to be running. We hope to have that up running hopefully by the end of next week if temperatures look good. But by this point, we'd be, you know, pretty much on the tail end of the steelhead run, and it really hasn't even started yet. I'm sure there's a few fish in the rivers, but typically we're looking at river temperatures to get 40 degrees before we see the first big push of steelhead coming into the rivers, and we're not even close to seeing that maybe for another week or two even.
You know, it's so interesting because, like, I guess the lake ice and river ice are just kind of two different stories, because I remember in 2013, I think it was our first year of a May sailing trip, and we couldn't even get the boat. Like, we literally got the boat in the water the day the trip was supposed to begin because there was so much ice in the marina. And yet this year, the marina's been free for a long time. And so we, on the one hand, we have all this snow and cold and precip, and then on the other hand, the lake's just been wide open.
Right.
So it's just really interesting to see how. Would you say you've seen less predictability or greater fluctuations in spring since it started? Or has, I know that there's always a tremendous variation in spring, and always has been as well. So
yeah,
it's probably a little hard to gauge.
Yeah, I think, you know, the variation is the big part of it, right? I mean, we've seen our steelhead run, and that kind of what gauges our spring operations is when the steelhead run starts, because that's really the first point where we're getting out and doing field operations is that steelhead run. We've seen it as early as mid-March. We've seen it as late as, you know, the beginning of May, which is where we're going to be this year.
Yeah.
But typically, you know, we always kind of hang our hat on April 1st is where we're going to, kind of that first week around April 1st is where we're going to get started. These large snow events that we see, especially this year and last year, you know, that kind of adds another layer of complexity to it, because especially when we get in a time frame like this, if we still have a lot of snow up in the highlands, up in the headwaters of our watersheds, we might get warmer temperatures. But all that warmer temperatures does is melt the snow.
Right.
That snow melt's still 32-something degrees. And if we're wanting those river temperatures to get up to 40, every time it gets warm outside, it melts more snow. That water temperature actually drops.
Oh, interesting.
Right? So
right.
There's this weird dynamic when we have these large snow events. And, of course, I'd much rather see large snow events, good, consistent regeneration of our aquifers. And, you know, I'd much rather see that than, you know, trying to get our rivers up to 40 degrees to have a steelhead run. But, you know, it's just when we get into these odd year events and these odd weather patterns like this, you know, it it's always hard to judge how it's going to come across.
Right.
Because, you know, we're looking at the 10-day now, barely over 45 degrees during the day. Overnights are still dropping below freezing. But after that, it could be, you know, 5 days of 70 degrees and here we go, right?
Right. Right. And what I've heard is they're already calling for a strong El Nino next winter, which would mean extraordinarily dry and warm.
Okay.
So who knows?
Right.
Who knows what's going to happen? But clearly, you need to be ready to expect the unexpected. I have one more question before I let you share whatever else is on your mind. But there's recently been maybe this is unrelated, but there's been announcements about the rainbow trout and how there is a PCB caution about that and the plastics in fish. Have you been involved in this at all? I know mercury in fish has been a concern for a long time, but this kind of seems like a new thing, and maybe not your territory, but if you have anything to add to what's been said about that.
No, you know, I haven't heard anything or been involved with anything with PCBs and plastics in rainbow trout at all. You know, anytime we talk about fish consumption, we're always concerned about any sort of chemical contaminant concentrations that are limiting how much fish folks can eat. You know, we want the cleanest water, so we have the cleanest fish, so we're not having to put restrictions on anything. I've been involved with a PFAS study in the Lake Superior Basin looking at fish concentrations with working with the MPCA, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, on that. I think results of that study should be coming out fairly soon, but it looked pretty promising. It looked pretty good, I think, for PFAS concentrations in most areas in the Lake Superior Basin that we looked at.
Okay.
But those results should be coming out here shortly, so we might have some more detailed information to share.
Yeah. Well, when we talked with people from Sea Grant, they said, don't panic at this moment. Like, there's a lot of studies still being done. There have been PFAS plastics around for a long time. Yeah. And it's also in the soil and the water. And it's just a long-term exploratory thing. But meantime, we are hearing more and more about reducing plastic, which I think could be right. only a good thing.
Yep.
So wonderful. So what else are you, how is the funding happening for, are you able to do what you need to do in your department?
We have been able to do what we've needed to do in kind of kind of a bittersweet way of going around it with COVID and and the hiring freeze that we were in. We had such salary savings by not having as many employees that there was an excess. No, I don't want to say an excess, but there was more money than we had anticipated having to have in this last few years. So we were able to put in for and get some money to do quite a few projects that we've been wanting to do and that we have in our long-term tenure management plan for Lake Superior. One of those in particular is looking at brook trout genetics on the North Shore and coaster brook trout. So coaster brook trout are any brook trout that spends any portion of its time in Lake Superior.
Okay.
And the beauty with coaster brook trout in Lake Superior is that they can get to be 20, 22 plus inches long, which for brook trout is amazing. Right?
Yeah.
We're typically looking at 12 inches is a great brook trout, right?
Yeah.
So if they get out into Lake Superior and they hang out there and take advantage of the resources there, they can get to be large sizes.
Hmm.
And the question lake-wide is always, you know, are these fish that are spawning in Lake Superior, are those populations, adult populations in Lake Superior spawning in the rivers? And especially on the North Shore with our waterfalls, you know, it's not like the UP of Michigan or Canada where they have these long, uninterrupted stretches of river from the mouth to the headwaters. We have a waterfall barrier within the first 100 yards or a mile of stream. So on the North Shore especially, we're really interested in our above barrier or above waterfall brook trout populations, our below barrier brook trout populations, and then those populations out in Lake Superior. And we did an initial look, genetic look, using SNPs, which is single nucleotide polymorphism genetic analysis. We worked with some researchers out of Michigan State doing that work, and it's a really, really high resolution genetic analysis. And our first pilot project that we did see kind of data supporting that our above barrier or our above waterfall brook trout populations are really providing brook trout to Lake Superior to then become coaster brook trout. So they're not the big coaster brook trout out in Lake Superior are not a different genetics of brook trout. They're not a distinct genetics of brook trout. They would be what we would call a life history variant. So you know, they're not an above barrier brook trout staying in the river the whole life cycle. Part of their life history is being in Lake Superior and then, you know, figuring out how to spawn and reproduce and do what you have to do in Lake Superior or its tributaries. So what we're really interested in now, and so that was looking at maybe a dozen streams along the North Shore. We expanded that with some of this additional funding that was available to us through Minnesota DNR and fund some additional genetic analysis of about 20-some streams, looking at those above barrier populations, below barrier populations, and in lake populations. And we were also able to secure some additional EPA funding through Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, lake-wide action and management planning, which is another kind of realm of Great Lakes work. We were able to get some money from them to allow us to deploy a field crew to get samples above barriers. And that essentially took us all summer. But really what we're looking at now is the genetic makeup of those above barrier populations, the genetic makeup of the below barrier populations, and then the inlake populations to see how all of those populations relate or not. Are we seeing coaster brook trout spawning and recruitment below barriers, and that's feeding lake populations? Or if the majority of our coaster brook trout being produced in Minnesota are coming from above barriers, then as a management agency, that tells us we need to turn our sights away from the lake and look at our watersheds, because the more that we can do in our watersheds, the better we can do to protect cold water seeps and springs, regenerate the riparian forests, work on habitat above barriers. If that's truly the case, then doing all that sort of work is going to give us more brook trout and thus give us more coaster brook trout out in Lake Superior. And, you know, historically, prior to, you know, even roads being built along the North Shore, that coaster brook trout fishery was a very popular fishery, very expansive fishery. You know, we have old reports from the 1800s talking about folks taking little Mackinac skiffs from Duluth up to the French River and catching 300
yeah.
brook trout, you know, averaging close to 2 pounds
yeah.
Near the mouth. So
yeah.
it was a very expansive, very abundant fishery, and we're looking to recreate that, hopefully, by some of the work that we're doing here lately.
Wow, lots to the story. I'm speaking with Corey Goldsworthy. He is the supervisor for the Lake Superior Fisheries with the Minnesota DNR. We're out of time, Corey, but this has been really interesting. And I got to ask, are you fishing these days?
Oh, I hope to get out this spring yet.
Okay.
You know, I didn't do much ice fishing this year. It was kind of with the heavy snowfall, it was kind of a hard
yeah.
ice fishing year. And this spring, for sure. My I have two young boys, and they've been itching and reminding me constantly that we've hardly went ice fishing this year. So
oh,
this spring, we'll definitely get after it.
You'll get out there.
Yep.
Wonderful. Well, thanks. We'll have you again soon. I can tell there's just lots to talk about.
Great. Thank you.
That was Corey Goldsworthy with Lake Superior Fisheries. And that interview will be rebroadcast tomorrow between 9 and 11 a.m. So tell a friend.